Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning are probably two of the most persecuted and hunted people on the planet at the current time. The crimes that they've exposed, the people responsible have faced not a single minute in jail, not a single minute in a courthouse, whereas Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning have, between them, faced many years in jail in courts trying to defend themselves and fight for their freedom. And even the recent victory that Julian Assange has had in a British court is the most qualified victory imaginable. He hasn't won a political victory. None of the political argument or the legal slash political arguments put forward by his defence were accepted by the judge. The victory has not meant that he's been released from prison. The conditions that he's being held in being absolutely horrific. And the victory does not mean that the world's biggest imperialist power are not continuing their campaign to hunt him down and try him for espionage. So I think it's absolutely imperative that anyone on the left defend Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. There have been a lot of very out there moments. For anyone who's followed Julian Assange's escapades over the years, there have been many out there moments, from appearances on the Ecuadorian embassy balcony, the intrigue, the going from country to country, popping up and revealing incredible things. But probably the most significant revelation that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have been responsible for came in April 2010 when Assange fronted a press conference in Washington, D.C., organised by WikiLeaks. And all the media were there. There was a lot of hype about this press conference, and Julian Assange was extremely nervous. And after a short introduction, Assange started this video that's now playing behind me. It goes for 17 minutes, so we can't really watch it, but you can get a taste from it here. And what goes on in this video that is referred to as the collateral murder footage is you see from Apache helicopters, US troops shooting at people on a Baghdad street, killing at least 11, possibly as many as 18 people shot dead, including two children who are seriously injured, who are passengers in a van that comes to provide aid to the people that were shot in the first round of shooting by US troops. And we're not going to hear the audio, but the audio adds a whole more revolting element to the video, where you can hear the US troops who are responsible for these shootings congratulating themselves for their efforts. They say, part of the audio is them saying to each other, "Oh yeah, look at those dead bastards, good shooting." And when they see the children in the van have been very seriously injured, they say it's their fault for bringing them into battle. And the idea that these children were brought into battle is a point I'll get to a bit later on. But the first and most obvious thing about the video that strikes you is how horrific it is from a humanitarian point of view, the gloating, the self-congratulation, the obvious enjoyment that the troops take out of treating people in Baghdad as target practice. And this is certainly not the way the US military have, in their official communiques, presented the operation in Iraq. What they claim to be doing is spreading democracy and the disarming weapons of mass destruction, which we're all assured were there. So it's horrible at at the most basic human level. But the second thing is that what made Assange showing this footage at a press conference in Washington so sensational was that this footage has a particular significance, because for 2 years prior to the 2010 showing of this footage, there had been a whole back and forth going on between the US military, the White House, and the Reuters news agency over whether such footage existed at all. And the US military had consistently denied that there was such footage, that there was, that basically it didn't exist. And so for the US military, who were in attendance at Assange's press conference, to be without warning confronted with this footage was extremely embarrassing for them. And of course, the reason that the Reuters news agency had been making inquiries of the US military about this footage is that two of the people that are shot and killed in this video are Reuters employees, one a photographer and I think one a translator. And so for obvious reasons, they wanted to see our footage of it, which, you know, only makes you think where there aren't employees of major Western companies being shot at in the street, you know, no one does request the footage of these incidents, you know, how often that goes on. But the fact that the Reuters had been asking to see this made it all compounded the embarrassment and really the lies that WikiLeaks was exposing, A, that the US was not doing any good in Iraq and that they were not being honest with the public about what they were doing there, and even in response to legitimate inquiries. And I think this is the whole story of the Iraq War. The control of information in regard to the Iraq War was, and like in most wars carried out by imperialist powers, was absolutely suffocating. The only real media that came out was through what's known as embedded reporters, which are where, you know, some reporters at the whim shown around Iraq and the US military operations by basically a PR person from the military. This was the major basis of the New York Times reporting of the Iraq War, for instance, that was overwhelmingly favourable coverage of the Iraq War. Well, during the US occupation, every single communications device in Iraq had to be registered with the occupying power, right down to typewriters. If you had a typewriter in your home, the US had to know about it. And also, you know, computers, any other means of communication. And it's important to realise that pretty much, you know, the atrocities that have gone on in Iraq that we do know of, you know, the Abu Ghraib prison torture, for instance, a very large proportion of them, it's because someone has been willing to speak up and expose the lies at great personal risk and cost to themselves, not ever because that information has been willingly given. So the other thing of importance about this footage that we see in the collateral murder video is that this incident is not unusual. It's unusual in the sense that it's one of the few pieces of footage that's been gotten a hold of by the public. But as Ethan McCord, who was a US private, who was actually on the ground, not in the helicopter, but on the ground rescuing people after the attacks, describes, these sorts of incidents were absolutely routine in Baghdad. So Ethan McCord is the person who actually went and helped pull the children that were injured out of the van. And you can watch his description of what went on there on YouTube. It's absolutely horrific. Like, to say two children injured sounds like quite it's a very sanitized version of what actually happened to these two children. And he was at first, because he was quite naive going into the war, he didn't think it was possible that these shootings could have been carried out by US troops. He thought it was, I don't know who he thought was firing from Apache helicopters, but he couldn't initially believe that it was his own, you know, fellow troops. But he sort of, the scales fell away a bit when he pulled the children out of the van and took them over to the helicopter that they had arrived in. And his commanding officer said, leave the motherfucking children, and that they were there just to clear up the mess and get out and not provide any assistance. So his whole experience of it was pretty horrific, but he said, you know, this was a fairly day-to-day occurrence. And indeed, Chelsea Manning describes how in the intelligence centre that she worked in, the sensitive compartmented, whatever that means, information facility, where the intelligence analysts did their work, soldiers would often come in just to watch footage like this, because actually, as everyone knew and as Reuters well knew, the US keeps footage of almost all their operations like this, and soldiers would come and watch it as entertainment. They called it war porn, and the analysts would, you know, show it to them, and it was all considered a big joke and like like the reason they were there, entertainment. So the fact that there were actually journalists that were killed in this particular incident is really important for why it was a very politically loaded piece of footage and also really why it's come to public attention at all. There's another element of significance to the presence of the journalists, and that is that the US has always claimed with this footage that it was enemy combatants that they were shooting, that the people, the men on the ground that were the targets were armed and were, you know, whatever, trying to attack the US. Of course, armed combatants in Baghdad trying to fight off an invading and occupying power, you know, it's bad enough that they're treated as criminals by the US occupying force, although fairly predictable. But it also was pretty clearly knowingly a lie. The RPG being held by one of the men, which was one of the key reasons the US argued it was justified to have shot these people, was, of course, not loaded, turned out not to be loaded, although the US always maintained it was. But in fact, as anyone, Ethan McCord said, as anyone who's been on the ground in Baghdad would have known that whenever there are journalists present, people in Iraq, in Baghdad, come out of their houses and show their weapons because everybody has weapons. It's a highly militarized society. And people come out and brandish their weapons in order to, in the hope that the photographer will take photos of them and they will make it big in the Western media. It's a very normal thing to have happened, and anyone familiar with the situation on the ground would have known that. So people come, you know, because the journalists were there, that's what was likely the scene here that the US said was armed combatants, and which, you know, suggests that there was no genuine belief that these were armed combatants. Anyway, like, this video, you know, was horrific to watch, is appalling, but it is just one of a huge trove of things released and exposed by WikiLeaks. And it spreads across every element of government and military operations, hundreds and thousands of documents and cables about, you know, US crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also diplomatic cables from governments all over the world about their private communications, where they talk about the really dirty detail of running modern capitalism. And to get an idea of the scale, the 250,000 diplomatic cables released by WikiLeaks in 2010 came to, according to The Guardian, about 300 million words, which compares to the Pentagon Papers, which was a fairly sensational leak in 1971 published by the New York Times. It exposed that while the US was saying that it could win the war in Vietnam, it actually was not labouring under that delusion at all. Those leaks were only 2.5 million words, so it's an enormous amount of material that WikiLeaks has made public. And it's significant because I think the intensification of secrecy in modern capitalism is absolutely overwhelming. And the WikiLeaks revelations have both highlighted the degree of criminality on the part of the world's rulers, but also has pushed back to some degree against the intensification of security and intensification of secrecy. And obviously secrecy is nothing new in capitalism. That, you know, way back in 1793, journalists for the first time shortly after the Great French Revolution won the right to take notes in Parliament. Before that, we weren't even allowed to, you know, Parliament was not considered the right of anyone to know what went on there. So yeah, basic things like that have only really recently been won. But I think what WikiLeaks exposes is the huge gulf between, you know, the way governments present, which, you know, a lot of effort goes into presenting a narrative to the public today through a whole army of PR and spin people, and what actually goes on the ground and the lengths they'll go to keep that information hidden. And this came up really early on with WikiLeaks, like before any of these major kind of things that put WikiLeaks on the map. In 2008, they leaked information about tax evasion by Barclays Bank in the UK, one of the biggest banks. And at the time, this was, you know, not only scandalous because this major bank was trying to avoid tax, but also because The High Court in London had banned the publishing of documents of public interest and prevented the media reporting on the case. And there was even the suggestion that parliamentary debates shouldn't be reported on either. But WikiLeaks defied this by releasing all the information about the Barclay Bank case, and then all those laws then just became an absolute a farce because the information was all public. And, because of the nature of WikiLeaks, they couldn't do anything about it. The US, all governments don't just rely on using laws to prevent, to keep their activities hidden. In fact, they depend on a very high level of cooperation from the corporations that, operate within their state. So in response to the massive diplomatic cables leak by WikiLeaks in 2009, the US government, retaliated. They tried to shut down the site. And one of the ways they did that was by trying to get all the corporations that WikiLeaks depended on to operate to also sabotage the operation. So tried to get Amazon to shut down the server. They WikiLeaks, I think, has to operate on more than several servers, so that if some government gets one company to cooperate with them shutting it down, there's another one that they can start up on. Then PayPal, Bank of America, American Express, all the financial companies that WikiLeaks relied on to get its donations and pay people to have their servers operate and function, were the government very easily elicited the cooperation of all these companies to sabotage WikiLeaks, and that can be just as damaging at times as the government just making laws about it. And here in Australia, though, it's been very much at the level of government intensification of secrecy and an attack on transparency. There was actually, ironically, a range of reforms in 2010 to make government more accountable, so making freedom of information more accessible to people. There was the creation of the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, which was an attempt to provide a conduit between the public and information about government activities. But since the election of the Liberals, and particularly the Abbott government in 2015, cut funding to this office, tried to repeal its the laws that created the office, though that was unsuccessful, and have tightened up some of the regulations around freedom of information. The area in which this has been most extreme has been in relation to refugee policy. So despite the fact that the Abbott government came in promising, their main, if not only promise, was to stop the boats in office, as soon as they got in, they created the conditions whereby nobody, even if you supported this slogan, nobody could even test whether the government had delivered on it. Dutton said that there would no longer be any public announcements about boat arrivals, or there'll only be press conferences once a week, not as, regardless of developments. He used a range of anti-whistleblower laws to intimidate people out of speaking about conditions in Australia's detention centres. So the Department of Immigration actually has the largest number of freedom of information requests of any government department. It's never granted a single freedom of information request about Nauru. It doesn't allow anyone to travel to Nauru. It has a 10-year jail term for anybody that speaks out about the conditions on Nauru who works there, and jail time penalties for anyone that publishes any revelations that people who work on Nauru make. And in fact, in 2016, when the Nauru papers were released to The Guardian by someone who does work on Nauru, Dutton immediately went after them with trying to get the Australian Federal Police to track down who did it, although they have so far been unsuccessful in relation to that. Another way that they've ensured secrecy is to increasingly militarise the refugee policy. So the Operation Sovereign Borders that Dutton implemented in 2013 increased the role of the military, and this is obviously repressive in a number of ways, but one of the ways is that there's no freedom of information in regards to military operations, so there's no point even asking. There's no right to know about anything that the military does. Dutton also makes sure that the Department of Immigration never refers to refugees by their names in any of their official communiques, because, in fact, it's a lot easier to get a Freedom of Information request granted if it's in relation to the to an individual. And I think it's like 89% approval. You can find out if you're trying to seek information about an individual. But if it's information to do with a government policy, it's you have about a 39% success rate at getting a response from the government, or getting what you want from the government. And even then, a very large proportion of that is so seriously redacted that you can't actually make sense of what you're given. And so by not ever referring to asylum seekers by their names, it makes it a lot harder to ever have a successful Freedom of Information application in relation to what the government is doing to any particular one person. So they refer to them only as numbers or asylum seeker, whatever. So, yeah, and the Australian government follows through. The final way in which secrecy is been intensified in recent years is the secret evidence provision that the government has in relation to the character tests for people applying for visas in Australia. I mean, the irony of this government imposing a character test on anyone is quite absurd, but even when they are in the process of imposing these tests, they do not have to tell you what evidence they've looked at to decide anything either way about your character. And in fact, that policy of the government was recently struck down by the High Court, but Peter Dutton is leading a challenge to that decision. That's how important it is to them that they're able to, you know, just make these decisions behind closed doors with no accountability. And then there's been the very real persecution of people. Obviously, the Australian government is not directly involved with the persecution of Assange, but they are in the sense that they've never spoken out in support of, you know, they've not lifted a finger to stand up for the guy, and, you know, they back their biggest ally, the US, hunting him down. But they've treated whistleblowers in Australia exactly the same way. So one of the early ones, 2016, the poor sucker that exposed cost blowouts in the national broadband network, you know, the government went after them mercilessly. The probably most high-profile case is that of the person referred to as Witness K, who exposed the phone tapping scandal in East Timor, where the Australian government was tapping the phone of the East Timorese government that they were negotiating oil and gas rights with in the Timor Gap. And then not only going after the Australian government employee that spoke out about that, quite rightly spoke out about that, but also his lawyer, which is, you know, and this is a proceedings initiated by Christian Porter. Christian, the rule of law is absolutely sacrosanct. Porter, who is going after the lawyer of a whistleblower, which is, you know, fairly unheard of. Also, the guy who spoke out, the former tax office employee who spoke out about the way in which the tax office went after, you know, small fish, because people who couldn't afford accountants and lawyers to get them out of any tax-related debt, who the tax office knew they'd have a better chance of getting them to repay debt. Who spoke out about the unfairness of that, has been faced with criminal charges that have been pending for several years now. And also a couple of years ago, when Thomas Drake, who's a US whistleblower, was coming out to speak at a conference in Australia, Peter Dutton basically said that he couldn't speak in public. He probably would have cancelled, would have prevented him entering the country had he realised, but at the last minute they realised who this guy was and told the organisation that was hosting the conference that he wouldn't be allowed to speak. And these sorts of things go on all the time, like just a systematic intimidation of people that, you know, not, just trying to, you know, in the case of the Witness K speaking out about criminal activity the Australian government has been engaged in, that no one even disputes, no one disputes the veracity of the claims, but that it's just purely a matter of this is an embarrassment and we want to sweep it under the rug. And that's why I think, you know, Assange and speaking out in defence of him and making this a bigger cause than it currently is absolutely essential. I think as well it's raised a whole lot of questions about the role of the media, because the media has really distanced itself from Assange now. He's not as much of a cause celeb as he was early on, which I think is a real problem and actually quite disgraceful. And it's a break from the way he's been treated back at the beginning of WikiLeaks, when some of the, you know, they weren't quite the enemy of the US empire that they are today. I think that's made a lot of people go a bit weak at the knees. So, for instance, one of the early revelations from WikiLeaks was about tax evasion in the Cayman Islands by Julius Baer Bank, along with other corporations. And Julius Baer Bank, which is one of the corporations exposed to tax, whatever they do in the Cayman Islands about tax, brought a court case against WikiLeaks because of these revelations, on the basis that it was, you know, violating the privacy of their clients. And the court found in the bank's favour and ordered that WikiLeaks' website be shut down. And there was a huge campaign in defence of them, and, you know, all these journalistic organisations, the civil liberties organisations, free speech organisations in America, rallied to the defence of WikiLeaks, and very successfully, like within a couple of weeks, the court reversed the decision, which was quite an incredible victory. And the whole basis of the argument was, this is a threat to journalism and the public's right to know. There was no question that what WikiLeaks was doing came broadly under the banner of journalism. And so in that sense, I think it is important to situate Assange's activities in WikiLeaks as part of the broad church of journalism. But at another level, Assange is not at all like a conventional journalist. Just to give an example, so the collateral murder video that I just showed, Assange had distributed this to some of the major media organisations in the US before the press conference, but none of them had been willing to publish it. And even after the press conference and the video had been made public, there was a lot of news organisations, including CNN, who refused to show it. And the reason for this was they were worried that about the effect it would have on their relationship with the US military, which speaks to the dependence of so many media organisations on currying favour with and having, you know, inside relationships with the powerful, with powerful institutions like the US military, so that they can get exclusives, so that they can get, you know, basically just more intel on stuff that might be newsworthy. And this means, you know, always an eye to how do they protect these relationships and, you know, not publish things that will embarrass the organisations that they depend on to be a proper player in the news world. Because if you can't get these sort of stories, then you can't get the hits or sell the papers or attract the viewers, which brings in bigger advertising dollars. So the very business model of most of the mainstream media is very frequently an argument against publishing awkward truths for the capitalist system. And so, yeah, you only need to look at the coverage, mainstream media's coverage of the Iraq war. It was just like that from beginning to end. You know, the uncritical reports of, you know, the claims about weapons of mass destruction, when Tony Blair put out his ludicrous dossier about, you know, weapons of mass destruction could be launched from Iraq and hit Britain within 45 minutes, you know, where there was never any evidence for. And the media dutifully reported all of this. And then you wonder really why people accept that Trump, you know, when Trump goes on about fake news and all the rot in media establishments and the related organisations, that people, you know, people, it's quite a logical thing to believe that when one of the major operations of the US government, the war on terror, was entirely based on lies that the media uncritically by and large promoted. So there's an inbuilt bias then against truth. Doesn't mean to say that the mainstream media never report things. And in fact, I think you can see with the whole Christian Porter, the campaign by the mainstream media against Christian Porter, where it's a situation where, for whatever reason, the media is prepared to burn bridges with the Liberal government over this issue. And you can see the impact that can have on public debate and indeed on the government's ability to operate. It can start to push real cultural change. So you can imagine if the media were prepared to have that approach to every human rights abuse that the government carries out, the world would be a very different place. But by and large, the media doesn't do that because, you know, they have allegiances to the powerful. They want to keep in good with them. And also they accept the kind of ideology that's built up around that to justify that, you know, the media has to act responsibly and the media does have to have an eye to maintaining the integrity of the system, that they're not there to pursue a political campaign to bring it down. And so in that sense, WikiLeaks is not like the mainstream media. And I think for us, that's a particular reason to defend them, to defend the organisation, defend Assange. But, you know, for the right-wing media that want to distance themselves from WikiLeaks, who claim that WikiLeaks isn't part of, you know, journalism broadly defined, we say that, no, they are. So that sort of, as I just hinted at, gets to some of the, and this I will wrap up very shortly, the reluctance on the part of a lot of people who would ordinarily be champions of people that are persecuted for speaking the truth, being unwilling to really do what needs to be done for Assange. So like The Guardian, The New York Times, The Washington Post, they've, you know, sold many, many papers on the basis of splashing the WikiLeaks revelations over their front page. But when it comes to, you know, Assange facing 180 years or whatever in a US military prison, it's sort of, I think The Guardian ran a small editorial. The New York Times has run many hostile opinion pieces to Assange. And I think this is both that the confronting power all got a bit bit too serious for these outfits. That it was one thing, you know, the occasional bank doing something dodgy in the Cayman Islands, and even, you know, the collateral murder video, there was a justification from the media's point of view for that. But, you know, the scale of the leaks, and in particular the reaction of the US empire, I think has somewhat scared the bejesus out of a lot of those outlets. It's one thing to kind of hold power to account. It's another thing to become public enemy of the world's biggest and most powerful force on earth. So added to that, though, I think the fact that, you know, Julian Assange has been accused of sexual assault or had that associated with him. We don't know whether that happened or not because there's never been any process to go through to discern it either way. But I think the fact that, you know, it says something that the mere allegations of sexual assault can be the defining aspect of someone's character, when the only reason we're assessing this person's character is because he's brought himself into conflict with the world's biggest, most destructive and murderous power that has ever been known to humanity, the United States military and government. And so I think that even in the event, you know, to defend Assange and his heroic acts of speaking truth to power is not to endorse every aspect of his character and everything he may ever have done in his life. And in fact, to take particular things he might have done in his life as an excuse not to back someone when, you know, the overwhelming thing about them is the, you know, conflict with the US is ludicrous and just seems like clutching at straws, finding excuses not to defend him. Secondly, I think the fact that Assange didn't, WikiLeaks haven't restricted themselves to leaking information about the kind of George Bushes of the world or Donald Trumps, like the kind of established hate figures of the liberal establishment, and that they've also released information about, you know, Hillary Clinton's emails and the Democratic National Convention, sabotaging the Sanders campaign, the fact that, you know, it extended to what's supposedly our side, the Democrats in America, have meant that people, oh, well, that's, you know, that's beyond the pale as far as they're concerned and don't want to defend him. And so I think that's why there's, you know, not the noise around what's been happening to Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning as well, that there really should be and that the cases really deserve. I think that's absolutely why you know, we need to fight for them. We need to understand that, you know, they're important public figures because they've taken on the US government, the US military, and that is a force that needs to be taken on mercilessly, not only when it's sort of convenient or in a way that, you know, protects the integrity of the system, but in a way that's designed to bring down a system that creates the US military and the destruction that it wreaks. I think that's why we're proud at Red Flag to have backed Assange and Manning. The first ever edition of Red Flag actually had the headline Chelsea Manning as a hero, or what her name was at that time. And, you know, that's a tradition that we want to stand in and build on.